Our reading from today is from page 1016, starting at chapter 4, verse 1. Since therefore Christ suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves with the same way of thinking. For whoever has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, so as to live for the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for human passions, but for the will of God. For the time that is past suffices for doing what the Gentiles want to do, living in sensuality, passions, drunkenness, orgies, drinking parties, and lawless idolatry. With respect to this, they are surprised when you do not join them in the same flood of debauchery, and they malign you. But they will give account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. For this is why the gospel was preached, even to those who are dead, that though judged in the flesh the way people are, they might live in the spirit the way God does. The end of all things is at hand. Therefore be self-controlled and sober-minded for the sake of your prayers. Above all, keep loving one another earnestly, since love covers a multitude of sins. Show hospitality to one another without grumbling. As each has received a gift, use it to serve one another as good stewards of God's varied grace. Whoever speaks, as one who speaks oracles of God. Whoever serves, as one who serves by the strength that God supplies, in order that in everything God may be glorified through Jesus Christ. To him belong glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you. But rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed. If you are insulted for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. But let none of you suffer as a murderer or a thief, or an evildoer or as a meddler. Yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in that name. For it is time for judgment to begin at the household of God. And if it begins with us, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And if the righteous is scarcely saved, what will become of the ungodly and the sinner? Therefore, let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good.
Thank you, Diane. And as Phil said, my name is Rob. For those of you who don't know me, I'm on the teaching staff here. And it's great to see you. A very warm welcome. Especially if you're new or visiting, we get a lot of people passing through London, and you're very, very welcome with us tonight. As it happens, you've come for the second in a couple of sermons about suffering, so it's going to be quite a sobering topic tonight, but I hope you'll get lots out of what Peter has to say to us. Now, is there anybody going to the pub after the service tonight? Anyone going to the pub? Yeah. Got Tim at the back putting his hand up. Looks like he might be going on his own. The rest of you are probably too shy to say where you're going. Anybody playing board games as usual after? Yep, so Fiona on her own. Don't know how that's going to work. Again, I presume the rest of you are too shy. Well, if you've got nothing else to do after the service, does anybody fancy a spot of suffering? You see, I know this bloke. He really hates Christians and he will happily heap abuse on us for as long as we've got. Anybody fancy it? Or maybe you like your suffering served a little hotter. Maybe we could find someone to burn us at the stake. It's happened to Christians many times in the past. Fancy that? Well, of course not, right? I mean, we're not masochists, are we? However, as Christians, we must be willing to suffer. None of us want to. We haven't been talking about it for the last couple of passages in 1 Peter because we like it. But we must be willing to suffer. Do you remember the slander we saw 2 weeks ago in chapter 3? We may well be slandered for following Christ, maybe by friends, family, colleagues, course mates. Certainly by the media. Christians are often the butt of jokes, the weird ones in the sitcoms. Certainly by politicians. Remember Cameron's get with it to those conservative Christians with their conservative beliefs. certainly by some academics, Professor Dawkins, who thinks that we believe in a dangerous superstition that is dragging people back to the Middle Ages. Are you willing to be the butt of jokes? To be considered and called odd? To be marginalized, ostracized, even sometimes demonized? Are you willing to suffer? And you know, the thing is, I think it's even harder for us in some ways because we live in an age that is set on and is good at pursuing the eradication of suffering. I wonder, has anybody used an appliance this week that makes your life easier? Or an app that makes your life easier? Have you used a painkiller this week? Gloriously, lots of us are expecting or having babies at the moment at Euston. I've yet to hear of any mother giving birth who hasn't opted for the painkillers, for the gas in the air or something stronger. And of course they do, because why wouldn't they? Suffering's horrible. The thing is, we're kind of programmed, aren't we, by our culture to pursue and even expect a suffering-free life. And praise God that we can have it in so many ways. It's not a bad thing. But the thing is, that sometimes makes choosing suffering as a Christian even harder for us. And that's one type of suffering that we can't just anaesthetize away and mustn't. Peter wants to help us. He wants to change our attitude towards suffering. You see, it turns out willingness to suffer as a Christian has some really big benefits that we're going to see tonight. The first of them is it's going to help us in our battle with sin. To stop living for sin and start living for God. The second big thing it's going to show us is that we really are members of God's household. It's going to give us confidence about our status before God. And both of those things we're going to see are really important because of the time that we live in. You see, the days of sin are numbered. And only those people who are really members of God's household have a future awaiting them. A future worth speaking of. And so if suffering helps us turn our back on sin and gives us confidence we're really members of God's people, then, well, in some senses we should even be glad of it. If you talk to the generation that went through World War II, they'll tell you that us millennials were a bit soft. They knew how to suffer. They went through a war to protect the comfortable lives that we now enjoy. War. That's the kind of time when, in some ways, it's worth suffering, isn't it? The thing is, though, as Christians, we are at war. Do you remember that from earlier in 1 Peter? So look with me at chapter 2, verse 11. Flick back a page. Peter says this to the people he's writing to. I urge you as strangers and aliens to abstain from fleshly desires which wage war against your soul. Back to chapter 4. You see, sin daily launches its assaults against us. We are at war. And so Peter, in verses 1 to 11, calls us to take up arms against sin. So, 1 to 11, arm your minds for suffering, because it's time to leave sin and live for God. Our first point. And look at the arms that he tells us to take up. Verse 1. Since, therefore, Christ suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves with the same way of thinking. For whoever has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. Now, that is a weird weapon to take up, isn't it? To arm yourself with. The same thinking as Jesus who suffered willingly in the flesh. How is willingness to suffer like Christ a weapon against sin? That is bizarre. Well, first of all, let's just see that it really has some big firepower. So verse 2, Peter says, whoever's suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, verse 2, so as to live for the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for human passions, but for the will of God. Do you see how strong this weapon is against sin? If you're willing to suffer, it enables you to say no more to human passions and to say yes, Lord, to the will of God instead. But how? How does it work? Well, remember the big flow of Peter's book so far. He's told us as Christians that we have a radical new identity. In Christ, we're God's holy people, in exile in this world, God's people. And that radical identity leads to radical conduct. We now live like Christ in this world, lives of submission and love, saying no to sin. Radical identity leads to radical conduct, leads to suffering. The bad mouthing of 2 verse 12 and 3:16. And, well, we see it again today, don't we, in 4 verse 4, when we'll get maligned for refusing to join in the flood of debauchery. And here's the key point. If we are not willing to suffer insults, then we won't be willing to stop sinning. You see, if we're not willing to suffer, we're just going to keep joining in everybody else's sinful behaviour. Because if we don't, then we will suffer. Do you see? Willingness to suffer is key if you want to make progress in living differently, living radically, fighting sin, leaving it behind and living instead for God. Now, I think this expands our understanding of the battle with sin. We often talk, don't we, about the battle with sin as resisting temptation, a particular desire that sin dangles before us like the proverbial carrot. Do you know the proverbial carrot? The carrot and the stick? Does that make sense? A positive motivation, a negative motivation? Nobody's nodding. I've got no idea whether this is completely lost on you. The idea is that there's something you want that gets dangled in front of you, a carrot that you chase after. And sin's like that, isn't it? A temptation. Go on, you know you want to. But then also there's a threat. If you don't go for the carrot, you'll get beaten with a stick. Now, why it's a carrot, I have absolutely no idea. Personally, I hate carrots. I'd far rather it was a biscuit. But you get the point of the proverb. A carrot or a stick. And we know we've got to resist sin's carrots, but sometimes we forget that resisting the carrot necessarily means we're choosing the stick. If we resist the carrot, we'll stick out from the world around us. We will attract insults. We'll become a target. And if we aren't clear on that and aren't willing to consciously choose that path, then when we do get abuse for the choices we make, we'll be broken down so much more quickly. I used to play rugby as a young, fit teenager. I'm now a bit sort of tired and unfit. And just last year, 10 years after not really playing rugby, my college had a rugby match. It was 2 years ago, in fact. And I spent the whole afternoon running around trying not to pick up the ball so that I wouldn't get hit. And yet that's what we can be like with sin sometimes, isn't it? Because we're unwilling to take the hit of being insulted, sometimes we just don't really engage in the battle. We're unwilling to turn our back on sin and live differently. Maybe there's a relationship you desperately want, but you know it's holding you back from living for God's will. It's so hard to say no to the carrot of intimacy, to the feeling of being desired by somebody you desire. But even harder, when all your friends are saying you're mad, you're an idiot for refusing to go out with them just because they're not a Christian. What's wrong with you? For some of us, it's going to be the relational cost in our families or amongst our colleagues as we refuse to join in living for the shared idols of our culture. Did you see them? Peter mentions them at the end of verse 3, lawless idolatry. It could be the false religious idols of your family, perhaps. Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, whatever it happens to be. Maybe it's the false ideological idol of pluralism in your HR department that forbids you from, well, heaven forbid, trying to persuade somebody that they're wrong about their views. Maybe it's the material idols of your family, your friends, the pursuit of career or wealth that your parents long for you to bow down and worship. You see, as we say no to lawless idolatry, we will be maligned. We simply will. For others, of course, it might be a battle with other things there in verse 3. Maybe it's the culture of sexual promiscuity and drunkenness. Two things that go hand in hand, not just in verse 3, but throughout the history of human culture. Do you find it hard not to join in the drinking games with your colleagues, your sports team, your course mates? You know, perhaps the underlying problem is not so much that you love getting wasted, but that you're unwilling to be different and to suffer insults for it. You know, all of us are going to have battles, tales of battles won and lost on this front. All of us. I do. I'm sure you will do too. But when we do find ourselves joining in, we need to remember the time that we live in. The time that we live in. Did you see the time that Peter keeps mentioning over and over and over again in these verses, 1 to 11? Say verse 3. The time past is sufficient for living like the Gentiles. Or verse 5, God is ready to judge the living and the dead. This word ready is a time word. It's almost time for judgment. God's ready for it. Or again, look at verse 7. The end of all things is at hand. Time is almost up on this world. It's almost up. And that's why we should leave sin and live for God, even if it brings a little suffering today, because the end is nigh. Now, as it happens, that's one of the things we get mocked most for believing. The end is nigh. It's a kind of slogan you see on placards of crazy Christian street preachers with their megaphones. But the end is nigh. It's not actually meant to be a slogan here to hurl at outsiders through megaphones. It's meant to be a rallying cry for us in the battle to leave sin and live for God despite the suffering that it can bring. Do you see? The time we live in, it's a bit like the time of being engaged. I know we've got a couple of people like that amongst us tonight, at least. When I was engaged to Amy, my wife, we weren't married already, but the end was nigh. Now imagine, in that time, I had started dating other girls. That would have been shockingly inappropriate, wouldn't it? And a similar thing is true for God's people. We're still in exile. We're living in the world of verse 3. But Christ is going to come any day now to judge the living and the dead. A day of great reversal that Peter talks about here. All who have mocked the gospel will, in verse 5, give account for their words of mockery. Whilst all who believe the gospel, even those in verse 6 who have died, they will be made alive in the spirit, that is, given a resurrection body. The same thing that happened to Christ in chapter 3. The end is nearly here. And that must change how we live today. Imagine Christ came back to find us flirting with idols or getting drunk like everybody else. That would be shockingly inappropriate. And can you see how much better it is to live for God's will rather than living for sin? God's will is just so much better than getting drunk. He's not a killjoy when he asks us to say no to sin. He's urging us to say yes to something much, much better. To getting, verse 7, to getting sober. To getting our lives back on track. Be self-controlled and sober-minded for the sake of your prayers. A new relationship with the maker of the universe in which the all-powerful God listens to my prayers? That's amazing. That's what he's calling us to. And it's not just a new relationship with him, it's a new relationship with each other as well. No longer treating one another as objects for our personal gratification, but, verse 8, above all, keep loving one another earnestly, since love covers a multitude of sins. And it's not just love in the abstract either. Look at verse 9. Show hospitality to one another without grumbling. A warm welcome. Opening our homes to one another, feeding each other, looking out for each other, making our spare rooms available to each other, and without grumbling. And, you know, it's amazing to see this happening today in Euston Church. Long may it continue. Long may we grow in it. So much better, isn't it, than that kind of hospitality you get where you go around someone's house and you just get the feeling you're not really that welcome and they're going to spend a long time whinging about you after you've left. Well, none of that amongst us. A warm welcome, without grumbling. We're family. You see, the world might not like us a lot of the time. Not all the time, but some of the time. But we're going to look after each other. Boy, are we going to look after each other. If we have assets or talents or homes, then we don't get proud about them as though we were self-made people. But verse 10, as each has received a gift, use it to serve one another as good stewards of God's varied grace. We recognize that all we have is a gift from God given to us by the generous giver so that we get the joy of giving generously to each other. It's amazing, isn't it? It's a beautiful way to live. Now, was anybody here at the Proverbs weekend, last weekend? I know you were. Finally, a few more nods around the room, not just Tim and Fiona. Well done, those brave people who just nodded. First of all, do you remember how Chris showed us the good life from Proverbs? The life lived, acknowledging that God knows best, the life that does good to others and is good for us. And remember how he showed us that Peter's actually quoting from Proverbs here in verse 8. You see, it's not just time to leave sin, it's time to embrace the good life. The God-fearing, God-glorifying good life. It's good for us, it glorifies God, it's good for others. But when we live this way, leaving sin and living for God, it will bring suffering. So we must be clear in our minds that it really is time. It really is time. Right, let's move on to verses 12 to 19. Maybe so far over the course of this first point and chapter 3 2 weeks ago, some of you have been a little bit annoyed by how seriously we're taking all this slander stuff. I mean, once again, being called names, it's hardly the end of the world, is it? Some of our brothers and sisters, as we've heard, have to go through far worse than that. People are being killed daily for Christ. So Anya's conservative estimate of about 7,000 a year, that's what, 20 a day? There's about 240 people here, maybe, at a guess. So that's a congregation this size worth of Christians being killed every 12 days around the world. Can you imagine that, 12 days? So what would that be? 2 weeks ago, on Friday past, we're all gone. Why are we making such a suffering mountain out of a slander molehill in the face of a statistic like that? Well, the thing is, Peter sees that all kinds of suffering, whether the fiery trial or just insults, they're all of a piece with one another. And yes, he acknowledges that the heat is sometimes massively turned up for some people, but suffering is suffering, whether the heat is high or low. And whatever kind of suffering we're going through, Peter calls us to have a radical perspective on it. Suffer gladly. Again, because of the time we find ourselves in. Again, in verses 12 to 19, there are two types of suffering. Verse 12, the fiery trial, and verse 14, more insults. And whether or not Peter meant fire literally, we can't know. But his words must have had great resonance for the Christians who would be burned as human torches just a few years after he wrote this letter in AD 64. You may have heard of Tacitus, the Roman historian, who recounts this torture as the Emperor Nero burned Christians, making them scapegoats for a great fire that had come on Rome. And Tacitus, he sort of has pity on these Christians. He says they're suffering unjustly. They weren't to blame for this great fire. But then he goes on to insult them pretty badly. He says this about Christians. They are horrible, disgraceful, followers of a destructive superstition. It's interesting, isn't it? Can you hear the ring of the words of Professor Dawkins in those words? It's remarkable. Nothing changes. And of course, it was because of the climate of general hatred and insult that Emperor Nero could so easily turn up the heat. Don't be surprised if the heat gets turned up. Whether it's being burnt at the stake or getting grilled with insult, Peter wants to give Christians a radical response to suffering. So some responses not to have first, don't be surprised. Or verse 16, if anyone suffers as a Christian, don't be ashamed. And then there's a response that we should have. So verse 13, suffer gladly, rejoice. Rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed. Or verse 14, if you're insulted, realize that you're actually blessed. Now, has Peter lost the plot? How can you get joy from suffering? How can we say we are blessed when people are doing the complete opposite of blessing us? They're insulting us, cursing us. Well, the thing is, in both cases, suffering for Christ proves that you're a real member of God's household, God's people, a true follower of Christ. Suffering reveals your true identity. Did you see that in verse 13? It's not just suffering we should rejoice in, but sharing Christ's suffering, because that shows we're on the path to sharing his glory too. It shows we're real Christians. Now, it's very easy for me to talk about violent suffering, but let's face it, I have no idea what the reality of this fiery suffering is really like. But you know, Peter, he did. He'd seen his friends martyred already by this stage. He was to become a martyr himself. And he insists, nonetheless, that Christians should rejoice when they suffer in this way, because it shows who they really are. Followers of Christ on the road to glory. But now the second type of suffering, that's far more familiar territory to us, isn't it? Insults. I guess most of us here will have suffered at least some kind of mockery from somebody at some point. If you're interested, I can tell you afterwards some of the things that my big sister calls me. Not particularly pleasant. Not the end of the world, though. But when I'm insulted, do I believe that being insulted for Christ isn't something to be ashamed of, isn't something to be embarrassed about, but actually shows that I've chosen a glorious path in life? That's the big question here. Look at verse 14. If you're insulted for the name of Christ, you're blessed. Why? Because the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. So easy, isn't it, when others look down on us for being a Christian, to start buying into their view of us. I'm an embarrassment to many members of my family. And I can buy into that. I can get embarrassed about my faith. And yet Peter says, no, you've chosen a glorious path. This phrase about the Spirit coming down and resting on us in verse 14, it's actually a quote from Jesus' baptism. Do you remember that? Where the Spirit comes down like a dove in bodily form and rests on Jesus to mark him out as God's beloved Son. And Peter says the insults that you endure as Christians, they do the same job of marking you out as God's people, his children. Only Peter, he tweaks the quote from the Gospels here to ram his point home. It's not just the Spirit of God, but the Spirit of glory and of God. You see, the insults that are meant to expose how much of an embarrassment we are, they reveal the opposite. We are glorious, God's glorious people. Nothing to be ashamed of about our new identity. Nothing at all. We are to live unashamedly glorifying God as Christians. Now, why is it worth suffering just to prove you're really a member of God's family? Well, verse 17, because of the time again. Because it is time for judgment to begin at the household of God. And when I first read that in my preparation, it was a very unsettling verse. You see, it sounds almost as though Peter's saying, we're going to get punished in some way. That's what we often think judgment means, don't we? But judging can actually have several meanings in the New Testament. And it can't possibly mean being punished here, because we just saw in chapter 3 that Christ died taking our punishment on himself. And we've been told repeatedly over the last few verses that we are blessed. Blessed by God. Blessed. So no, it's not that we're being punished. Judging can also have the sense in the New Testament of sorting. Do you remember Jesus in the Gospels when he judges between the sheep and the goats? Those people who are really part of God's family and those who aren't. It's a sorting judgment that Peter must have in mind here, given what we've just seen in verses 12 to 16. You see, the time has come for us to suffer because God is working out who is really a member of his household. You see, it's only those people who are willing to suffer for Christ who are really his people. You wouldn't suffer for Christ if you don't really believe in him, would you? That's how God sorts the sheep from the goats, the outsiders from his true family. Now, we said earlier that suffering insults, it's not the end of the world. But that's wrong. You see, Christians suffering insults and being sorted by God that way, it is the beginning of the end. Did you see that? Verse 17 goes on. If judgment begins with us, what will be the outcome of those who do not obey the gospel of God? And verse 18, if the righteous is scarcely saved, what will become of the ungodly and the sinner? You see, the sorting judgment that's going on as we suffer and stay true to Christ and prove that we're really God's people, that is the beginning of the final judgment, when God will come and judge those who are not his people. You think it's hard suffering as a Christian in this world? Sometimes it is, you're right. It does make it hard to be saved. We're scarcely saved, said Peter. But the difficulties we face are nothing, not a patch on what those who do not know God are going to face. It's a sober note to finish on, isn't it? But can you see, given this time that we live in, why it's so precious to know for sure that we are genuine members of God's household? If you don't, you're in a very precarious situation. It's sobering, isn't it? And if you're not a believer tonight, you may well think, after all that we've said about the end of the world, that you have landed amongst a group of crazies. Well, let me promise you, we don't believe this on a whim or because we've lost our minds. There is good evidence for it. Come along on Wednesday nights, look at the eyewitness evidence of Jesus Christ's life, death, resurrection. There is hard, eyewitness, believable evidence. But for now, for us Christians, are we willing to suffer? Let's finish with the words of verse 19. Therefore, let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good. You see, we're not being asked to suffer for a morally dubious cause, but for doing good. We're not being asked to suffer at the hands of random evil that's out of control, but according to the will of God, according to his good purposes. And we're not being asked to suffer without hope. God is a faithful creator, and he will bring all who have suffered for Christ into Christ's glory.